Welcome back to Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bodrovics, and joining me today is returning guest, Tavi Costa. He's a portfolio manager for Crescat Capital. How are you today, Tavi?
Good, Tom. Looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for having me.
Me too. Tavi, before the call, you and I were starting to discuss how your real macro overview at Crescat informs your micro way of investing. So can you tell me a bit more about that, please?
Sure. I think I look at the world with more of a macro lenses, and it's nice to have co-portfolio manager here, Crescat Capital, looking at things with more of a value approach. So it's almost like an overlay of the two investment theses or approaches. And if you look at Crescat in a way of creating models and quant models in general, I think it's almost like a research and development part of the business in which we use that to come up with our themes. And we have been using that for some time now in terms of fundamental equity models and macro models to really try to score where we are in the business cycle today, and perhaps look in a way of more unbiased form of finding out themes and investment themes in general. Today, we have three major themes in the portfolio. I would say one of them is the possible decline and downturn in the business cycle in the U.S., in which we express that by being short a lot of equity, the equity market here, by again using the models to select a basket of companies that we view as the most overvalued companies in the world today. The second one would be the China credit and currency bubble, in which I think it's almost related to this global synchronized debasement theme, in which we think that fiat currencies are in a race to the bottom in general here, especially relative to gold. And the third one would be the long precious metal side of the theme, which is, I think, is looking at the world in such a pessimistic way. It's interesting to find one very opportunistic part of the market that we think that it's in, on the long side will benefit from this macro environment with so many drivers behind it. So different ways we use different asset classes. Most macro investors are seen as only investing in the fixed income market and the currency markets, not us. We do anything that we would like to use in terms of markets to implement those ideas. And today we have a very significant part of our portfolio in equity markets, in which we think is the best way to implement those trades, especially in the precious metal side, in our view. So it's sort of how the investment process of Crescat has evolved over the years, but it's nice to overlay all those different investment approaches to really try to figure out the best ways of being invested in this macro environment.
Excellent, Tavi. So your Twitter is an absolute treasure trove of valuable charts that you guys put out. And I'd like to start with one of the first ones. And just as a reminder to any of the listeners that are just hearing this on a podcast app or anything, we'll have all of these charts on the video on YouTube and links to Tavi's Twitter feed at Tavi Costa. But let's start with the first one of treasury cash balance versus bills outstanding. So basically what you were talking about is that the treasury is holding a ton of cash right now. So what's the importance of that?
Well, I think it has to do with the way that the treasury has been really funding a lot of its debt. Since the pandemic started, what we had is debt has been soaring in the government side and the corporate side too, but especially in the government side. And most of that, about 70% of the debt issuance by the government has been through the treasury bills, which are very short-term securities, and they mature in less than 12 months. And that caused the treasury bills outstanding to be close to $5 trillion, which is unprecedented, not only on the absolute terms, but also on a rate of change terms as well. We've never seen such a strong growth of issuances in that part of the market. I think that forces the Treasury to hold a significant portion of cash as they have to roll those securities going forward. It creates another question, in which is when you look at the amount of treasuries that will be maturing in the next 12 months, it will be significant. About $8.5 trillion worth of treasuries will be maturing by the end of 2021. The real question is, who is going to be the buyer of those treasuries? And I think that the buyer, if you look at a trend of charts, which I think is a chart that you have there with you as well, which is looking at the foreigner ownership of treasuries, especially in marketable securities. Most people have been looking at, I think that everyone should be looking at the marketable securities part of the treasury. And when you look at that, you can see that there's a declining trend on that for the last decade or so. At the same time as the Federal Reserve has been becoming, I guess, the buyer of last resort in the last decade or so. So there's a convergence between those two trends, which I think that that creates not only the reason for debt monetization, I guess. And the second part of this is that I think that the Federal Reserve will continue to be a bigger participant of this market going forward. And that gives us the question about what is going to happen with especially central bank assets. I think that that will probably provide an outlook in which the Federal Reserve will probably continue to expand its monetary base to fund fiscal stimulus, which I think is a perfect mix for precious metals overall.
Excellent, Tavi. So the next chart that I'd like to go through with you is called twin deficits versus gold to S&P ratio. And you were saying that it's an inverted deficit chart, and it really shows us how much of a deficit the US is running right now. So explain to us why this is such an important chart as well.
Yeah, well, that's an important chart because a lot of people like to talk about the deficits that has been progressively getting worse. And it's an important part in the fiscal side, but also the current account side, which is mostly on the trade balance, that is also turning negative and it's near all-time lows. It's almost as close as it was at the worst part of the global financial crisis in 08. And when you think about that, it also creates makes it a little harder as a dynamic to fund the treasury market too. And I think that when you look at historically, empirically as well, is that when you look at that inverted versus gold, the gold to S&P 500 ratio, you see that gold tends to outperform overall equities as you have this sort of fiscal and monetary disorder getting worse, which is the case when you look at the fiscal debt, the twin deficits worsening over time. And also, I think that this time around, we really took this deficits problem in general to a whole new level, in which I think it could give an even higher support for the gold trade, especially relative to overall equities at near record near record valuations in general, too. So this monetary basement is basically the only way out of this debt burden that we're seeing in the world today, in which, I do think the fiat currencies are in the race to the bottom. And it's almost in a synchronized way when you look at gold relative to almost every currency has been rising significantly recently. So this lack of alternatives in terms of risky assets, not only record valuations, but also when you look at yields of investments are also yielding less than inflation in a lot of places. I'll give you an example. Equity markets are yielding pretty much in real terms, lowest level in a decade. The last time that happened, gold also outperformed overall equities. So it's giving you a lot of reasons to own precious metals relative to equities, especially the S&P 500. So I think empirically, it makes sense to own gold. I like to say this as a buy gold and sell stocks. It's just a simplistic way of putting the whole thesis together. And one way is to buy not only gold, is buying gold and silver and miners. We can get into that as well. But there's so many drivers for gold today relative to other assets that I think is what's going to drive the demand for monetary assets, especially gold and silver.
Absolutely, Tavi. And as you speak about, the real fundamental drivers for gold, as we know, one of the most tightly correlated charts to the gold price is also bond yields. So I have another chart here of global negative yielding bonds. And again, tell us the importance of this correlation with gold, please.
Yeah, there's so many takeaways of that chart. Well, number one, I think about $6.5 trillion of negative yielding bonds, especially in the sovereign market today. And that is one reason why, investors are looking for yields and looking for growth in general. There is no organic growth in the macro environment today, which gives us another reason for investors to look for precious metals as a way of seeking growth. But also, it's another question for the deflation and inflation debate about precious metals. I don't believe that you only have to see an inflationary environment, a rising inflationary environment to create a setup for precious metals, a very constructive setup for precious metals. I really don't believe in that. I actually think that precious metals today could work in both scenarios, the inflationary or the deflationary one. And a great example is looking at this negative yielding bonds environment that I think what's going to happen is as that breaks out to new levels in terms of the market cap of those bonds, I think it gives a further reason for investors to buy gold and silver. And so, I think a lot of investors have been looking at the TIPS market, for instance, as a way of saying, look, I think we already reached all-time lows in terms of real rates. Real rates have been a real driver for gold in the last decade or so. But the TIPS market only goes back to, the 90s or so. It doesn't have a very long history. I suggest investors to look at nominal rates versus inflation rates all the way back to the 60s. and 70s. And you can see that back in the 70s, especially in the mid and the late part of 70s, we had real rates reaching as low as minus 5%, or I would say minus 4.5% or so, which today we're far away from those levels. I think that as a driver, you know, it could continue to be that the tailwind for precious metals overall. So I'm a believer that that's one of the macro drivers, along with the twin deficits, along with the lack of alternatives for investments in the space and this demand for monetary assets in general. I think it's the largest mismatch between demand and supply that we've seen in the gold market in history.
Excellent, Tavi. So one of the last charts I'd like to go through on this to really contrast the money supply and the deficits right now is the monetary supply versus fiscal deficit in the US. And the chart goes back to 1970, as you were just saying, and it is just astounding how the deficit has grown in a way, and the monetary supply has also grown, and it is as far apart as it's ever been. So when do you think we're going to hit this wall and see some repercussions from this?
It's interesting. It shows that there's a lot of long-term imbalances catching up with the short-term here of the markets overall. So I think that there's some issues in terms of the fiscal and monetary disorder we've had since the break of the gold standard is a very important part. That, I think, was very impactful in 1971 in terms of how we really began to see the monetary policies really take a role in equity markets and financial markets as a whole. I think that unlimited QE, the statement that Powell did a few months ago, it was just as impactful. And I think that will force investors to be looking for things like gold and silver. I think it's important to look at that and think about how we've had a precious metals bear market for the last 10 years aligned with that. And it makes absolutely no sense, but it creates a huge opportunity, in my view, for this market. I think, you know, when you look at especially the supply side of gold, with companies being reluctant to spend capital in discoveries and supply, it's important to remember here the role for gold and silver as a monetary asset throughout history. And I think more and more investors will be looking for those assets to be protecting and growing capital going forward. So it certainly speaks about the need for monetary debasement going forward, given the amount of debt that we have in the system. I mean, corporations have never been so levered. Governments have never been so levered. And it's not only a domestic problem. We're seeing this globally. When you look at China, for instance, it's even worse. China is probably the most indebted nation in the world today. And I find it funny that a lot of investors have been calling for China to become, or the Chinese yuan to become, the new reserve currency here, when it's actually also not lacking in a huge way, you know, this fiscal and monetary discipline. And I think that investors will be looking for a metal rather than, or anything that is outside of being backed by governments as part of the monetary system. So I think gold and silver certainly serve that purpose. Perhaps Bitcoin does too. But the real beneficiaries of this all certainly are also the companies that are linked to the market, which I think are the miners. You know, there's so many reasons to own miners today that I could go on to. But for me, it really shows the level of imbalances that we have on the long term are starting to really catch up here, and it's starting to hurt organic economic growth. When you look at what we are today in terms of the recessionary signs, the recessionary problems that we had since the pandemic started, it's going to be very hard for companies to begin to grow organically. You know, earnings are not growing. We have earnings estimates down about 25%. Actual earnings are down 18% on a year-over-year basis. It's going to be difficult to see things getting better in such an indebted world. So I think for that, it's another reason to buy gold and sell stocks. At the same time, you have risky assets trading at record valuations. A lot of things don't make sense here in this market. And I think will force investors to look at a new alternatives, especially the large allocators that have been looking at precious metals have been so much out of favor in the last few decades. And I think that's about to change with the risk parity strategies starting to look for other ways of investing.
So Tavi, as you're speaking about China, the only real consideration that comes to mind, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, is that I think most people say that China owns all their own debt and the US has a lot of their debt owned by foreign entities. What do you think the considerations are around that, and if there's any real difference?
Well, one of the differences, I guess, which goes to your question, is the capital account being closed is a major reason why no one really owns Chinese debt. And if it was a capital, you know, if they would open their capital account, and I suggest people to study what happened in the 50s with Japan when they decided to open their capital account and they're largely indebted, very similar to China today, what happened was a large devaluation of the currency. I don't think there is a way around the amount of leverage in the system ends up creating a lot of pressure in the currency side. And that's why we see devaluations over time. I think it's the same issue with China, not to mention the political change. The political environment in the US versus China is very different. I find it difficult to see large funds and large allocators of capital investing heavily in places like China, given the authoritarian regime that we have in the political environment in China. So I still see the US as, you know, will continue to have, in my view, the status of a reserve currency going forward. I don't, you know, the situation of not owning the debt, of having China owning part of the US debt, I don't think it's so much of an issue going forward. I think it's an issue that we're seeing all over the world, in which debt monetization is happening not only in the US, but in central banks like Canada and Australia and Europe. It's something happening globally, not only here. And I think a lot of investors are missing that part. It's really a global synchronized debasement, in which gold is rising relative to almost every currency, especially the most overvalued ones. And it gives another point here, right? It's the whole idea of what are ways of investing on this. And miners is one way, which, you know, they not only benefit from the rise of metal prices, but also the miners that are outside of the US also benefit from the valuation of those currencies even further than in the US. So I think there's a lot of opportunities on that side as well. I hope I answer your question, which is, you know, regardless of who owns each debt, we'll continue to see the US being the reserve currency going forward, giving it's fundamentally stronger than any other fiat currency in the world today.
Interesting, Tavi. So as you say, this is a real global theme. And I think there's a couple charts that really show this. So let's take, for example, the number of credit card accounts is dropping precipitously in Australia. And also, you posted a chart recently about Australian rent. So tell us a little bit about that and what that's signaling as well.
Well, Australia is a great example of a place that has been very impacted by China. It's a place where capital outflows from China have exacerbated its real estate market. And, you know, as I said before, you know, the macro environment is severely impaired in an area like Australia too. We have a lot of leverage in the system, especially in the housing market for a long time. It's interesting to see this type of drop in terms of number of credit card accounts in Australia. I think it's aligned with this credit exhaustion sort of a theme that we've had here at Crescat. I think we're hitting that level in which it will start to really hurt global economic growth. And the global economy has never been so dependent on central bank policies. And Australia is a great example of that, and we'll likely see further monetary debasement because of that macro setup. The part of the rental market is a very important market for the Australian real estate market. As we all know, there's a lot of ownership of real estate in terms of that depend on this rental income to continue to prop up those markets. And I think that if we have a scenario where the rental market is declining, as we've seen in this chart, I think that that could trigger some other issues in a much bigger indebted economy, such as Australia. Canada has very similar issues in my view. And you can also see those problems in the banking industry of those two places, in which a lot of the multiples of those banks trade very similarly than they did here in the US with American banks back in 07 and 06 prior to the housing bust here. So I see a lot of similarities in terms of that. And I think it has a lot to do with capital outflows coming from China, which also cause issues in places like Hong Kong.
Excellent, Tavi. As you talk about Canada, there's one last chart that I really want to bring up on this, these macro themes, and it's the balance sheet asset to nominal GDP year over year growth. And Canada is just heads and shoulders above anybody else. And so that's exactly, you know, what you're speaking about, right?
Yes, even though it's coming from a lower base. So if you look at the Bank of Canada's assets relative to Canada's nominal GDP, it was about 7% about a year ago, and it's now close to 30%. So relative to other places like Japan and Switzerland, they're close to 130 or over 130% of GDP in those places. So the path has been laid out from those central banks. And I think other central banks will follow the same path. When you look at the issue that we're seeing in terms of deficits worldwide, you know, debt has been piling up in a pace that we really never seen throughout history, or maybe we've seen in some parts, but during World War times. And it's very severe. I think central banks have two new mandates today. And I think it's very important to point that out. One of them is to suppress interest rates. And by doing that, they have to expand the monetary base in order to do that. And the second one is to keep financial markets at those absurd valuations afloat. And again, I think the monetary policies, especially accommodative as we've seen globally, will continue to really continue to work on those two mandates that are even more important than inflation and the stability of those currencies. Monetary debasement is really the only way out of this debt burden. And they have really created a lot of issues. There's a lot of unintended consequences from this level of extreme policies to fund fiscal stimulus too. One of them would be the corporate bond market. And when you look at corporate bonds here, especially in the US, you see leverage is just rising at really unsustainable levels, historically speaking, versus corporate bond yields at near all-time lows. You have equity markets doing the same thing, right? Equity markets in terms of multiples, if you look at the tech market in particular, you can see that the tech market cap here of the tech sector is about 40% of the overall GDP here in the US. That never happened in history, not even in the tech bubble times. So there's certainly a lot of examples of excesses in terms of issues in the market. And I think it only creates a dependency of central banks going forward here. Unfortunately, there's a lack of skepticism among investors, in my view, of the risks that we see, which I think it validates also our views about the stage that we are in the business cycle globally. And so I think equity markets could be running out of thin air here very soon. And, you know, we could see some very problematic issues here going forward.
Excellent, Tavi. So let's turn a little bit to gold. And, you know, we've talked about the fundamental and macro drivers for the coming gold bull market or precious metals bull market. But I have a chart up of gold discoveries versus the price of gold. And this has basically been falling since 1990, you know, obviously not in a straight line, but it basically shows us that demand has never been higher for gold. And yet there's no new discoveries coming online, correct?
Yeah, so that chart is only looking at the major discoveries, which is over 2 million ounces of gold. And the last 3 years, certainly haven't seen any that are on that size. Ergo, at Crescat is to be part of some of those major discoveries going forward. But I think it speaks about how miners have been reluctant to spend capital, especially their exploration budget has been, you know, dismal in the last decade or so. And this conservatism in an industry, I think, is it not only creates this issue of supply to continue to be constrained for the long term, but also it speaks about the opportunity for miners in general, which, you know, have never been so prudent in terms of financially speaking, I guess. You look at free cash flow growth in terms of the industry has never been so high. I think last time I checked, the top 20 miners have grown about 130% on a year-over-year basis. And when you look at the CapEx cycle for the industry, it's the first time in history that is actually diverging from metal prices. Usually the CapEx cycle tends to follow gold prices, but this time around is different. That never happened before. And I think it has to do with this decade-long bear market we saw in the mining space. You know, I think that the mining space will likely become the new growth stocks like the tech stocks that we've seen. Matter of fact, if you look at the mining companies, they have been already outperforming a lot of the NASDAQ companies, especially NASDAQ index. And I would say especially silver stocks have been doing that. When you look at the equity dilution of those companies have been at one of the lowest levels in history. They've been paying debt. Their balance sheet had never looked so strong, especially relative to the overall market. If the mining space was a sector, would be the cleanest, would have the cleanest balance sheets of all sectors in the market today. And a lot of people don't think about that. So it's the only industry that we really see real fundamental growth. But, you know, again, it goes back to the thesis that you're talking about. It's the lack of supply along with all those macro drivers to drive the gold prices much higher. And those companies that do sit on the most prolific deposits in the world today will probably benefit tremendously going forward. And I've seen a lot of people talking about this, about the potential for a lot of consolidation in this market. And I think that that's probably going to be the case. when you look at the industry overall, I've said this before, but the precious metals industry is worth about $600 billion. Well, Apple's market cap is about 3.5 times that amount. So that is the asymmetry here for the trade. But also, when you look at that $600 billion for the overall precious metals industry, half of that is on the top miners. So not only there is a huge probability and potential for the smaller names to outperform, but I also think that the bigger names that have been so restricted on spending money on exploration to be looking for very positive exploration businesses around the globe. So, you know, our focus has been most on that segment of the industry, and I think we'll continue to look for the best deposits in the world going forward.
So Tavi, as you speak about the real macro drivers for the gold price, again, excellent chart here, great correlation of Fed balance sheet expansion, as well as you have the gold price put up against it. So it shows a great correlation between how the Fed's balance sheet expansion and gold have really grown together, correct?
Yes, I think that chart certainly shows that. It's just one way of measuring, perhaps. You know, it's very difficult to value gold. How do you value gold? And one way is to look at that monetary dilution that we've seen in the last few decades. And, you know, those are those long-term imbalances starting to catch up. And we've added somewhere close to $7 trillion in the global monetary base since the beginning of the pandemic. Over about half of that, I would say 40% or so of that was done by the Federal Reserve. And now we've seen a lot of central banks beginning to catch up to that amount recently. Well, the Bank of Canada is certainly one example of that. We need to see Australia catch up with that too. Australia is still very low relative in terms of the RBA amount of assets relative to its nominal GDP. So certainly there's a lot of room for growth in terms of that. A lot of economies, as I said, I think that the BOJ and the S&B has certainly sort of laid out the path for those central banks to continue to do that. And it's important to note that that doesn't mean we're going to see organic growth. If we learn something in history is that from the BOJ especially is that by increasing and expanding its monetary base, it has not created organic growth in their economy. Matter of fact, gold has performed incredibly well relative to yen in the last decade or so, much better than their equity market. So I think there's a lot of reasons to go back to that buy gold and sell stocks thesis. But certainly the difficulty of valuing gold, I think that one way is to look at global central bank assets and chart that and overlay that with gold prices. The other way to look at that is just look at the alternatives for gold. I've mentioned about the equity market yielding in terms of earnings in real terms at a decade low. But if you look at corporate bonds, for instance, in real terms, it's yielding negative. It makes absolutely no sense, right? I mean, those companies are extremely levered at the same time as those bonds are yielding negative or relative to inflation rate. So it gives, again, another reason for investors to look for appreciation of assets. And I think that gold and silver relative to money supply, relative to equity markets, certainly look attractive. And I think it's a matter of time until large allocators begin to realize that.
And Tavi, as you speak about gold and silver versus money supply, the last chart I have here to look at is silver relative to money supply. And it is at almost one of the lowest ratios we've ever seen. So again, this just points to being completely undervalued, correct?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. We've had silver had a very significant run up recently, which was reaffirming of our thesis. But also in the last few weeks, we've had a few declines in silver prices in which a lot of investors have really been questioning this thesis. I find it absurd when you look at that chart, for instance, in which gives you an idea of the big picture potential for silver prices still, not only relative to gold as well, but also relative to the amount of monetary dilution globally we've seen so far. You know, when you look at, for instance, equity markets relative to money supply, it's been doing a double top very close to the tech bubble levels, very different than silver near all-time lows. Not to mention the technical base that has been forming recently on this chart that I think it gives you another idea of how silver really could be breaking out in the following years. I really believe silver could be at $50 an ounce here very soon in the following, maybe in 12 months or so. Who knows how the economy will need in terms of monetary stimulus to continue to prop up markets in general. I think that will continue, especially given, you know, the level of issues that we're seeing in the U.S. economy. Anyways, I think silver is the cheapest metal on earth. And unfortunately, you know, when we were talking about discoveries of gold, for instance, you know, silver is even worse. As we know, there's a lot of, it's very difficult to find a pure silver miner. A lot of that is secondary through other, you know, mining of gold or copper, in which they end up finding silver. And a lot of those copper mines have closed recently because of the issues with the pandemic and other issues historically of, you know, commodity prices have gone nowhere but gone, you know, lower and flat for the last 10 years. And I think that that certainly caused a lot of impact on the new discoveries and supply of silver as a whole. Silver is a very industrial commodity, but I believe that if we see silver prices rising significantly from here, it will lose a lot of that aspect to it, which is a very cyclical aspect to the commodity, and become a much more of a monetary asset, as we've seen throughout history in other centuries. So I believe strongly that silver will be trading at much higher levels than it is today. And remember, a lot of those miners that are exposed to silver could be doing really well in the following years if silver prices, you know, do end up rising significantly from here.
Yeah, and I think one of the other kind of tailwinds for the silver price, as Ted Butler discussed in our last episode, was that basically JP Morgan's large short position is now basically non-existent, and they have a lot to gain from going long with their physical stockpile. So that remains to be seen how the silver price will react here, you know, coming into the end of the year. Tavi, one of the last questions I wanted to get your opinion on was, if you guys have any considerations towards, you know, a real liquidity crunch or another crash coming into or out of the election, with how much uncertainty there is around what's going to happen here. So what are your thoughts on that? And do you guys have a lot of cash sitting on the sidelines ready to deploy once and if you see something like that coming?
The only place we have cash in the sidelines is our large cap strategy. But I would say that that's the whole point of buying gold and selling stocks. And most people have said to me, well, why would you be selling stocks today or being short stocks, given the level of stimulus we're seeing worldwide that has been propping up equity markets? Well, the reason is exactly what you said. Well, there's a very high risk of liquidity problem. And certainly given, you know, the lack of US dollars outside of globally, outside of the US, obviously. And I think that that certainly could become an issue again. We're seeing some emerging market currencies is starting to show signs of those issues, you know, especially in Brazil. Brazilian real has been selling off recently, and it has in the past, as pointed out, has been a very important sign for issues with liquidity. So, you know, given the valuations that we are so extreme, it makes sense in my head to be selling short a lot of those companies trading at 50, 60, 70 times sales and buying the miners that are trading at, you know, 5 times free cash flow. So, you know, the difference in multiples is huge. And I think that that's the best way to hedge your portfolio. Certainly in the last 6 months or so, the long position in precious metals have worked really well, but the short positions have not worked and has cost some of our performance, even though we have performed incredibly well this year. But in the first quarter of the year, it was critical to have that short position, and was a major reason why we had one of the best March performances in the history of the fund. So I believe that that's an important part of the investment, is to have some short position, given the level of risk that I think a lot of investors are oblivious to, or perhaps just ignoring. And given the level of participants that we're seeing in equity markets in general, right? I mean, we've seen recently a lot of the retail investors participating in the market, which we haven't seen in the last decade or so, the same level of participants as we've seen so far. And as I said, I do believe that the tech sector is priced for perfection, which again is no one wants to touch the equity market. It's very interesting how everyone believes that we are in a bubble, but nobody knows how that's going to really pop. And I think that there is a business cycle, and this idea that central banks can prevent that from happening is a little bit absurd. And I think a lot of people will be proven wrong. And it's dangerous, in my view, for those that are looking into buying equity markets at these valuations. I think we've seen this in history. We're looking at valuations very similar to other equity bubbles. At the same time, they're completely detached from fundamentals that are very depressed, like we've never seen throughout history. So I think there's enough reasons for us to be short equities today and being long the gold market. And that has been working tremendously well. And I think we'll continue to do so going forward.
Excellent, Tavi. Well, again, just to reiterate, your Twitter feed is excellent. You provide lots of really great charts like the ones on this video, and that's at Tavi Costa. And you guys are also available at crescat.net, correct?
That's right. Thanks, Tom, for having me again. I appreciate the opportunity and look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks very much, Tavi. We appreciate it as well. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.
Think you understand the junior mining sector, and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people, hit the bid.
How violent that term could be, it actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw material. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?